place where they could go to and just be themselves. And now even that is problematic for many. So they don't have a place to escape to. And I'm a big fan of designing a life that you don't need to escape from.
Yes.
And once you get there, then yeah, vacations are great. You get to go to fun places. You're going to vacation because you choose to and you want to, not because you need to.
Yeah.
So, because if you need a vacation, then you need to look at, okay, how are you spending your time that's demanding you needing a vacation?
Yeah. I have a friend who's starting a business coaching with the angle of giving someone 8 extra hours per week and tripling their income doing it. And he did it. He followed someone's routine and it worked for him.
Nice.
So yeah, he's about to launch out into doing that.
Great.
And, yeah, he said these are, you know, 70, 90 hour a week executives. And I said, I actually want to talk to their wives because they'd be left at home an awful lot and feel isolated and probably have a list of things that for them aren't getting done because they're either too meek to ask or used to being supportive or think that they need to be there when in actuality, the best thing that these ladies could do is come on a trip, come do something. Like, what is something that would fill you up so that you have more to give?
Yeah. Yeah. Retreats and things like that, you know, it, just to get them a break from, you know, running the household, which is a business. Anybody that says it isn't is full of it because running a household is running a business. There's procedures, policies, maintenance,
you know, vendors, suppliers, all of it.
Benefits, employees, you know, and all that things. So it's like, yeah. So anybody that says, well, you know, I don't work, I work at home or I'm you know, a homemaker. I'm like, you're working harder than a lot of people.
Yes.
And I'm in enough offices and I see those people. I'm like, yeah, they're not working, but that's all right. It's up to them. You know, that's however they see fit. That's fine.
Well, if a person, you know, people can have a pain can become their new norm and don't even realize. And, you know, I think that kind of parlays into your work as the burnout guy. This is an untraditional beginning to the show, Michael, but I'd like to just keep going with it because what you're doing is out of the box, bringing attention to things in a preventative kind of way. Thanks, guys, for joining us on Bold Movers and Shakers. I have the astoundingly effective and organized and thought leader. Michael Levitt is with me today, and I'm thrilled to have him. He is co-author of the book Preemptive Strike Leadership. It's a big title. I'd love for you to explain the tagline and then tell people what it is that you do, Michael.
Awesome. Well, glad to be with you today, Alexis, and hello, everybody. Two books. We'll start with Preemptive Strike Leadership. Funny backstory on this book. I met Dr. Arlene Battisil, who's the other author of the book, at a conference in San Diego in April of 2018. And we were talking, and she was planning on having a men's only virtual summit. And she was familiar with my backstory. So she said, I want you to talk about burnout and things like that. So let's connect in a couple months and talk. And we talked a little bit and come to find out that she was based out of Los Angeles, but also her spouse works and lives in Toronto, where I'm based out of. So why don't we just meet in Toronto when you're in town? So we did that. And, you know, we're talking and going over some things and having conversations about just all kinds of different things, you know, work, workplace culture, you know, the challenges that we're seeing in the workplace, how 7 out of 10 people in Canada in a survey would take another job if they were offered it. So I'm like, okay, that's bad when, you know, 70% of your organizations would up and leave the organization.
And it's not just because they'd rather get out of Canada. It's not just the weather.
No, it's like, okay,
you have a
huge, exactly. It's, you know, so they're like, okay, what's going on with this?
Yeah.
And as we're talking, we start talking a little bit more about, you know, our background. And I said, you know, I'm originally from Michigan. And she paused and looked at me and she said, where in Michigan? And so I grew up in the Pontiac and Waterford area. And she said, I grew up at 7 Mile and Gratiot, which is about a 25-minute distance from each other. So here we are, somebody I met in San Diego, someone's from LA, I'm from Toronto, but we actually are both born, you know, within a 25-minute drive and, you know, grew up, you know, in the same, you know, education system, same environment, same, you know, it was like, okay. So that kind of explains why we were able to connect at so many levels, because we both grew up with the same crappy education. I'm saying that tongue in cheek, but it's true, you know. So we're talking, and we're like, and as we started going on, we're like, we should write about, you know, what we're talking about, some of these concepts and things like that. And that turned into, now mind you, this is June. So between June and roughly November, we wrote Preemptive Strike Leadership.
Wow.
And it launched on January 8th of this year. So from meeting somebody in April, never met them before, was unaware of who they were, to publishing a book that went number one on Amazon on launch day in Canada and hit number 10 in the United States in the risk management category. It was just like, okay, whoa, that's a lot. Yeah. So it's one of those things. And I always tell people, it's like, talk with people. You never know who you're going to meet or who you're going to connect with.
Yes.
And, you know, the premise of the book is, you know, I kind of alluded to it a little bit about how you have all of these employees that want to leave organizations, but in many organizations we have, and a lot of people understand what this means, are Trojan horses within your organization. So you've got organizations that are fearful of the competition, what's happening outside, cyber security breaches, all of this kind of stuff. But in many organizations, unfortunately, your biggest problems are within your organization. And a lot of people say, well, you're blaming employees. Like, employees are kind of the conduit of the situation. And all of our research and studies, a lot of times it boils down to how management communicates with the employees and how the employees are either engaged or not, and if they're a right fit in the organization or not. And what happens is you get into this interesting dynamic of what the organization feels is important for the growth of the organization and what the employees truly need. And in one of the biggest things that flushed out from us, and especially as our workforce becomes more and more based with millennial-aged employees, is the millennial generation has extremely different needs than previous generations when it comes to what they want out of the workplace. They want to make a difference. They want to have an impact. And they're driven. And this is why you're seeing a lot of people bouncing between jobs, because they're trying to find that, what I like to refer to, that utopian organization that meets all of their needs. Well, spoiler alert, they don't exist.
Yeah.
Even my own organization doesn't completely match up with everything that I need. It does a lot, but not everything. So organizations have to have those conversations and say, okay, what do you need? What type of environment do you need? What type of work do you want? What type of feedback do you want? Some of the great organizations that are doing really well with retention, they've taken a long, hard look at their benefits program, and the classic benefits that have been around forever. Here's your health insurance. Here's your life insurance policy. Here's this and this. Where a lot of the millennials are going, I'm up to here in my student loan debt.
Yeah.
So those organizations are saying, you know what, instead of giving you that $50,000 life insurance policy because you're 25 years old or 30, what we'll do is the money that we're paying for that policy for you, instead we're going to pay you so you can pay down your student loan debt. That's a huge burden relief for these people because it's easing their debt load and gets them to the point where they're going, okay, this is an organization that actually cares about me.
Yes.
Which in turn, as the employee, come in and show up to work and work while they're there. You know, another thing that we discovered, and this was through a white paper, an article that was published, on any given day, employees can bring in, I think there was about 65 items on this list, different challenges that we all face every day, whether it's we're a caregiver, we're having spousal problems, our kids are giving us difficulty, Our washer and dryer needs to be repaired, but we can't get time off of work to get it fixed. Cable installation, car's not working right. There's this huge laundry list of things. And getting time off of work is challenging. Many organizations don't provide paid sick days. So like, okay, well, I'm going to take it. I have to take a whole day off so I can get my washing machine fixed. I'm going to have to pay for the washing machine to get it fixed. Plus, I'm not getting paid that day. So organizations need to look at some different opportunities, either with flex time or some adjustments and things like that. Case in point, too, another organization I'm familiar with did this. You know, the statistics show that 50% of the population ends up in divorce that are married. Okay, so that's a pretty significant percentage. Now, if anybody that's gone through a separation or a divorce, they know that there is a lot of time in meeting with your attorneys, gathering paperwork and all of that stuff. So this organization, knowing that they had some employees that were going through that type of situation, made a modification to that employee's schedule. And they gave them two options. Number one, they could work four 10-hour shifts and have one day a week off every week. Or they could do the normal shifts and just, you know, work basically 4/5 or 80% of their schedule. And of course, their pay would be adjusted down, but it would be temporary while they navigate through these divorce waters.
Wow.
What that did was it freed up that employee, knowing that, okay, I know that I have every Thursday off to deal with that stuff. Yeah. So what that meant was when things came up, that employee knew I can deal with it on Thursday because I'm not here. Instead of, how am I going to deal with this? I've got this project that's due at 4:00. My attorney's needing this by 2:00. I don't have the paperwork here. It's at home. And all of these things. So what happens is you have an employee that really isn't engaged with their work because they've got these external challenges.
Or they're going to just, you know, whether they're engaged mentally or even just literally, they're going to be sneaking some time away because they have to. And then there's the guilt that comes with that, or the shame, or the lack of productivity, and then the hiding, and then, oh, yeah, babe, it's almost like feeling like you're cheating on the job.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, and their performance drops, and then HR gets involved, and HR starts putting them on performance improvement plans because you're not doing everything that you could.
As if they without more things to
try. Yeah, and what that ends up doing is it just makes it worse and worse, and all of a sudden you have an all-star employee.
Yep.
It ends up being let go because they're dealing with some stuff. It happens every day. Mm. And that's where we need to get away from that and get to the point where organizations and employees have more open conversations in a safe way, that the employee feels protected and the employer is investing in, you know, keeping their employees. Because replacing an employee, you know, depending on what level they are in the organization, you're looking at, you know, 130 to 150% of cost to replace an employee, especially someone that's been there for a while. Yeah. You know, someone's been in an organization for 5 or 10 years, that company knowledge is not easily replaced. Okay, so you have to bring on a new employee, you're training them, they have to get used to the climate and the culture and how things work and all the policies and procedures and all the fun stuff. But it takes them months to get fully up to speed and being fully productive for the organization. So if you're constantly hiring people to do that, your organization is never going to grow to where it could because you're spending all your time onboarding, and you'd be better off spending the time reinvesting in your people, giving them the professional development they need to be better at their job, be flexible with them as far as any unique, you know, acute episodic, using a healthcare phrase, situations where it's not long term, it's a short window of time, hopefully. Yeah. And when you do that as an organization, you retain people.
It was recommended to me the other day. I told a consultant that I've been a confidant for a long time, sometimes long term, years and years for one person. And she said, you know, there's really a need for what you do, maybe a 3-session kind of thing that an employer could steer someone towards, an employee, because you're an outside neutral. They can totally like let it all hang out and feel cared for because they're actually their employer paid for it. And it sure as heck beats, I don't know, fill in the blank kind of bonus, because it really directly addresses their concern. Boy, talk about feeling cared about. Mm-hmm. And it's a temporary situation in which they then get, you know, sort of fueled and renewed and perhaps feel even more dedicated than ever to their job in spite of what's going on, because now they have some support that they didn't have before and certainly can't share everything with their employer in spite of the new trend, I suppose it is, where the employers are being more empathetic. Mm-hmm. They're not meant to be parents or psychologists, and yet they're kind of having to, you know, figure out what it is, what is, what do they need? And it can be a mystery, and it's different for every single person.
It is.
Yeah. No matter how many water bottles styles there are, not one is a size fits all, you know?
Exactly. Exactly.
It's got to be deeper than that. And so where do you find it? What do you do? And, mm-hmm. and secondly, Michael, and I want to address this because of your work with the leaders themselves, who are also, they're almost like removed from their organization in their role as an isolated individual. And they have their challenges for being able to express who they are without it being inappropriate, I guess is the word. They wouldn't necessarily share with everybody what they're going through. And so because of that, that's almost like a projection. Like, this is where I am and this is how I deal with it. So why don't they?
Right. Yeah.
I mean, that's what we do. We assume the world will act like we do.
Exactly. And you know, leaders oftentimes, for right or wrong, end up isolating themselves. And I find that many of them are very, very protective of what's going on in their lives because they don't want to be seen as vulnerable. And because they're the leader, they're supposed to be strong and all of that. And they're going through some pretty significant things.
Yep.
And, you know, putting in some insanely long hours, which we see study after study that indicates our productivity after 7 or 8 hours goes into the toilet. It's like, so you're staying an extra 7 or 8 hours. You're producing less than what you would if you would have left after 7 or 8 hours.
Yeah.
And I talk to these people and oftentimes it boils down to a couple common elements. Number one, most leaders, executive level, tend to be type A personalities. So they're very driven. They've been very successful. They've rose through the ranks. They've done great work. You know, they became an executive in an organization either by, you know, rising up there or in another organization and then jumped over to take, you know, an executive role with a new place.
Right.
So they've got this expectation that they have to perform and have to maintain that level.
It's also how they got there. So it's
exactly natural.
Or, yeah, okay, go ahead.
Yeah, no, you hit it right on the head where they worked and worked and worked and they were doing things. But when you get to the executive level, you're not supposed to be doing, you're supposed to be directing. And it's a completely different ball game. And nine times out of 10, organizations do not train these executives how to be an executive.
No.
There isn't, you know, an executive 101 course that these organizations send people to. There's things you can do. And if you're a strong leader, then as you're going through the ranks and ultimately wanting to be a C-suite executive, then what you're doing is you're investing a lot of your time reading, studying, understanding, getting mentorship, all of that stuff to give you a fighting chance to be a great executive. But again, those are few and far between. I mean, there's plenty of them out there, but then for every, you know, 5 executives that are really good at what they do and they've got the proper training and the balance and all of that, you know, there's another 50 that are drowning because they can't segment themselves from being the doer and being a director. And it's a common challenge and they think that they can fix it by, you know, putting in those extra 5 or 6 hours a day.
Well, my father was an entrepreneur of the highest order who consistently said, if you want something done right, you got to do it yourself. And the lack of trust and may have been justified perhaps in, you know, previous experiences of people that didn't quite do what, you know, what he thought or whatever. This is a common theme I'm seeing with whether it's a solopreneur or a big company. It's still that mindset that I need to do this. I got to do this.
Yeah. And that was a big problem that I had a decade ago. I felt that, one, I could do it, but more so the people that I had hired, I knew were capable of doing the work, but they were quote unquote so busy, their words, not mine, that I felt, if anybody's watching, you know who you are.
I wish you could see his face right now, guys. Yeah. Anyway, go ahead, Michael.
So they were too busy. So I'm like, well, I'll do it because I can get it done. And if that's a one-off type of thing, fine. I don't want directors not to get their hands dirty because then they lose touch with what's going on with the organization and whatnot. But when you start doing that for everything, it goes from one thing to 10 things and all of that, then not only are you doing your job, then you're doing the jobs that should be done by somebody else. And so I was lousy at delegation. And now, you know, I've swung the pendulum the other way where anything that comes across my desk, I look at it and I think, who besides me could do this? And if I come up with a name, congratulations, you're getting it. Unless, now this is the asterisk here, unless I've already assigned them a lot of other things, or if they're working on a project that's got a due date coming up soon, then you kind of balance it. But you also have to look at it in a way of, okay, this thing landed on my desk, when is it due? I mean, when is it truly due? I mean, most of us, we are allergic to to-do lists. So we look at them and we go, okay, we got to cross that box off. And we go through life, check, 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 because we get, you know, a high off it, I guess. I don't know. But ultimately, it's like, number one, when it lands on your desk, you have to think, okay, is this something that we should be doing? Right. You know, a common question that I ask organizations to ask themselves, and individuals as well, is to ask themselves, who are we? What's our organization? What do we do? Okay, does this thing that just landed on my desk, is it in alignment with what we're doing as an organization? Does it make sense? Does it improve anything? Because if it doesn't, get rid of it. And because otherwise you're going to be spinning your wheels doing all these little things, and you're not going to be doing the thing that your organization needs to be done in order to be the best at whatever product or service that they offer.
There you go. There you go. So you've mentioned that you have another book.
Yes, 369 Days, How to Survive a Year of Worst Case Scenarios. I'm coming up on the 10-year anniversary.
Guys, you don't know what the story that's about to roll out is. Michael, you've handled it well, but he didn't always. And this is absolutely a 369 days of the worst year of somebody's life. It's a kind of going to summarize this well. But I want you to really hear this and ask yourselves, if this were to happen to you, would you have the ability to come out of it well? Mm-hmm. Because if you don't take a look at where things are headed right now, this might be you. So mm-hmm. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, in 369 days, starting from May 22nd, 2009 until May 26th of 2010, the following things happened to me. I had a heart attack that should have killed me. I lost my job during the economic recession, which we all remember quite well. Our family vehicle was repossessed. And then finally, our home was foreclosed.
Oh my goodness.
All in a year. Each of those issues are devastating to people. You know, if you have a heart attack, and at the time, you know, I was, you know, 40 years old.
Oh,
40-year-olds are not supposed to have heart attacks. And mine was pretty significant, especially where I had my blockages, which was the left anterior descending artery. And in the cardiology world, they refer that artery as the widowmaker, because usually if there's a blockage in that artery, the person, if they have a heart attack, does not survive. And now, last time I checked, I'm still here. I'm thankful that I'm here.
Yeah.
So you have a heart attack. Ironically, I was working in the healthcare sector. So thankfully I was at a doctor's office where I was working to notice what was happening, and, you know, had a procedure, had two stents put in that artery to open up the blockages, and, you know, here I am, you know, after that, I recovered for, I was on 17 weeks of disability to recover from that.
Wow.
And thankfully, because I, as the director of that organization and the benefits, we had signed up for a short-term disability package. So thankfully, I was getting, paid a portion of my salary while I was recovering, which was a great thing. Yeah. The organization, I don't think, was overly happy that we were paying for that policy, but you'll have to interview them on that. I'm thrilled that I did it. I don't know if they canceled it after I left or not. I don't know, and quite frankly, don't care. But I came back to a job that I no longer had because they wanted to go in a different direction. I'm not going to get in the details on that. I signed a non-disclosure, so I don't go into details on that stuff. But suffice to say, when you lose your job during the economic recession, and I was in just outside of Windsor, Ontario, which is a sister city to Detroit, we all remember what was going on during the economic recession. Yeah. The auto companies were about this far away from being gone. GM and Chrysler were bailed out by the government because otherwise they wouldn't exist today. And Ford was pretty close to it. So when you're in an area that is predominantly funded and supported by the auto sector, and the auto sector is about to die, needless to say, the jobs were not bountiful. So it took me several months to be able to find a new role, and I was able to, but it involved a relocation to Toronto. So I left a community area of around 200,000 people to a community of over 7 million. So slight traffic change. And so it was a big adjustment for me. And then after I'd been up in Toronto for roughly 7 weeks, I got a phone call from my oldest daughter, and she was crying, couldn't understand what she said, but finally was able to decipher that the bank had repossessed the family vehicle. Because when you're on unemployment and unemployment runs out and you only have a little bit of money, you're going to choose, okay, car payment or food. Now, here's a pro tip for everybody. If you ever get laid off, contact your creditors and your mortgage company and all those people immediately. Let them know. They all have a grace period, and we did that. But unfortunately, that grace period, had run out. And, rightfully so, contractual obligation. They give me something, I pay them. I don't pay them, they have the right to take it back. So I have no ill will towards the banks that we had financed the home and the car with, because I was not in alignment with the agreement. So no anger towards those organizations at all. I mean, yeah. It's the reality of it.
Sure.
So after that, we finally found a place to move into in Toronto. And our house, we were about ready to put it on the market actually that following week. And when we moved, we forgot the bunk bed ladder for our daughter's bunk bed. So I was going back to that area to visit my brother in a couple weeks. So I went down, visited him, and then swung by the house to grab the bunk bed ladder and just do another walkthrough to see if there was anything else that we had forgotten. But when I got there, I opened up the screen door and saw the hugest padlock I've ever seen in my life. And this is not a padlock you can buy from Home Depot. This was, I don't know where you get these things, but it was massive. And there was, basically a metal sheet that had secured the door to the foundation of the house with a foreclosure sign on it.
Oh my. Now,
what alarms me to this day was I didn't get any, final notice or even hate mail from the bank that they were going to do this. So it kind of came out of the blue. Because we were putting it on the market in a very tight market that we probably would be looking at, hopefully at least breaking even, and hopefully we wouldn't be under too much. But when we saw that, we realized, well, let me call the real estate broker and tell him, keep the sign in your trunk. You don't need to put it in the front yard unless they contact you to sell it for you, because the bank took it back. Needless to say, we didn't get the bunk bed ladder back. But thankfully, our middle daughter is kind of a monkey, so she liked the top bunk anyway. So she just climbed up the old fashioned way, the way we tell them not to do. We said, well, I guess you're going to be climbing up that way now.
Right.
So, and again, to recap, so in a year I had all of those things happen, yeah. And it was the best thing that ever happened to me, because it gave me an opportunity to take a long, hard look at how I had been living my life, both from a physical standpoint and from a mental standpoint, and realize that, okay, if I don't want this to ever happen again, I need to make changes, significant changes in my life and my mindset, how I approach life, how I make decisions, yes, how I let things impact me, all of this. And, you know, I took the time to do it. It wasn't an overnight, okay, I'm going to, you know, hit the treadmill and I'm just going to eat kale and that's all we're going to do. No, it wasn't that at all. I hope it wasn't. It was a slow thing, you know, and since then, you know, I've reinvented my life. I approach life much differently. Things that used to bother me don't as much. I mean, every once in a while things happen just because, you know, we have memories and things, but I have a better way of, you know, catching it, going, okay, I see why this is bugging me. You know, lost a ton of weight. You know, my cardiologist jokes, you know, when he has his heart attack, he wants one like mine, which I still look at him when he says that, going, why would you want to have one? You know, they're not fun. Okay. They're not a lot of fun. And
the head scratcher.
Yeah. And you know, when I remember when I was in the hospital too, they gave me a spray of nitroglycerin, which I refer to as the instant headache maker, because the spray, what it does is it forces all of your arteries in your body to just kind of expand a little bit. So it's like instant pain, like right here, which is weird. I mean, that's the brain just goes, what the heck just happened? But it's short. It's only like for about 30 seconds, but still it's like, but again, I'm thankful for all those experiences, because since then I reinvented my life. My career took off. I learned how to be better at my job. I went back into healthcare, which my parents wanted to have me committed, because they blamed the healthcare stress and, you know, all of that for the reason why I had my cardiac event. And I'm like, no, my lifestyle, what I was doing, the choices I was making, the lack of stress management, not being aware of what burnout was, all of these things played a huge factor in everything. And I was to blame for all of it. You know,
let me ask you something, love. Were you actually ignoring signs? Were you ignoring it, thinking you were like a German tank, going to power through it? It's not going to happen to you, whatever that it is.
Yeah, having a heart attack never crossed my mind. Yeah. You know, I didn't have any symptoms up to when I had it. That I was aware
of. The heart attack.
Yeah. That I was aware of. I was blissfully unaware of the stress and burnout, because when I talked with people, I said, oh yeah, you were burned out. I'm like, why didn't you tell me? And they looked at me and they said, would you have listened? And I went, ouch, no, I wouldn't have.
Wow. Let me jump in here, Michael, because with that in mind, I know that you went out with your book and you said, hey, here's what can happen. Mm-hmm. Right? Did people listen to you?
Initially, before I did the book, when I started noticing a lot of people, especially in the healthcare sector, initially were going down the same path that I did. Yeah. So I kind of did my Paul Revere, you know, it's like the burnout is coming. And, you know, again, for many of them, they're like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, okay, so this is what I was dealing with. I'm like, okay, I have to go about this in a different way. So I just started researching burnout, and it's not a new thing. Burnout has been around for a long time. I have a book that's titled Burnout from Dr. Herbenberger, which he wrote, and it was published in the late 70s. Okay. Wow. This is not new. It's been going on for some time, but I do feel that burnout is more prevalent now than it's been before, because of the constant connectivity that we have, the constant just on the go constantly. There's no disconnecting anymore. You ask anybody that watches television, for example, because television used to be the, okay, just unwind, sit, watch a sitcom, laugh, just kind of relax. But, you know, people that are doing that are still on their phones or they're on their computers or their tablets or whatnot. So they're doing a bunch of things at once and it catches up. People, I often say this, people have forgotten how to be bored. They don't have any way of just being. It's very difficult to find places where you don't get cell phone signals. I mean, even 5 years ago, I mean, there was always pockets like, I'm not getting a signal, I'll wait. Well, now, even in the subway system in Toronto, you can get cell coverage. There's a couple of providers that have, you know, coverage throughout. So you can be underground, under cement, and you can still be on your phone doing whatever you want to do. So it's one of those things where it's like, yeah, we got to learn how to separate from things and have a hard stop for the work we do, whether it's if we're working for somebody or we're an entrepreneur. Because if we don't, as I always say, if you don't take a break, you will break.
Well, right. And that was my next point, actually, to lead into, because the question, how bad does it have to get, is certainly answered by the individual. But it can be a choice. It can be proactive instead of reactive. And I believe that's the work that you're doing now.
It is. Yeah. For me, it's, I hope to find when I'm working with people that they're not at a completely burned out state, although many of them are. I hopefully I'm catching them at the, I'm extremely fatigued. It's leading into burnout. I'm stressed and this and this. So my first goal is to, using another medical term, let's stop the bleeding.
Yeah.
Let's get you to at least a state of calmness or just, okay, you know, that you can actually feel the breeze if you go outside. Okay, good. All right. Now the next step is let's start looking at how you spend your time. What are you doing every day? How are you spending your days? And I ask them, you know, how much time do you do this and this? And oftentimes they don't know. People don't track their time. You need to track your time.
I like the list that you make people do. I'm going to jump in on that one because that's smart. When was the last time you did something for the first time? That's the little quote that I look at in a poster I share with people. When was the last time you did something for the first time? Or even something that you know you love to do? Mm-hmm. You know, and go ahead, Michael, and share how that shows up. What happens? What do they say? What happens?
Well, I'll give you a current or a recent example. I was speaking about physician burnout at the Becker's Healthcare Conference in Chicago last week. And in the room, it was a panel discussion, had some doctors and talking about burnout and how it's such a huge challenge amongst physicians and all of healthcare. But I asked the audience, like, I'm going to give you, Professor Mike's going to give you some homework. And of course they're like, look, I'm like, what's this? So I told them, I said, don't do it now, but over the next couple of days, grab a sheet of paper or a couple sheets of paper if need be, and draw a vertical line down the middle of the sheet. On the left side, list everything that you enjoy to do that brings you joy and happiness, or things you like to eat or buy or whatever. Just be complete. This, like, things you really enjoy. If it's your favorite cup of coffee at a coffee establishment, or your favorite sandwich, your favorite place to go on vacation, your favorite t-shirt, your favorite sporting event, you name it. Just list everything that when you experience that, it just brings you happiness and joy and it relaxes you.
Yeah.
So, you know, take a couple of days to make this list as full as you possibly can. And if you forget something, you always add back to it later. But once that list is as complete as you think it needs to be, then on the right side of each of those items, write down the last time you experienced that situation or that experience. When I did that in the conference, I heard, I would guess, at least 15 people moan. And it was a self-reflection. And I asked them, why are you not doing things that you enjoy to do?
Yeah.
And I said, if you say you don't have time, that is a BS answer.
Yeah.
We all get 24 hours a day, every one of us. How we choose to use them is up to us. And if you're robbing yourself of these things, it's going to catch up with you.
It's also going to affect everybody around you, because it takes a strong person, if not just an unfeeling person, to not have some level of resentment or what have you. It may be misplaced, misdirected, but still, it's what shows up. I mean, you know, that awful question, is this all there is? Mm-hmm. Oh, God. You know, that's a terrible feeling. And what you're saying is that it's within your grasp to no, you can say, no, it's not. Let me just add this little piece right here. Mm-hmm. At least I'll feel like I'm doing something that's gratifying personally.
Yep. And then the follow-up component to it is, after they write down all the dates, I tell them, okay, in the next 10 days, pick 3 of those things on that list that you enjoy doing.
Yeah.
And schedule it on your calendar. Do not cancel that appointment. Treat it as if it is your performance review with your boss. If you miss that review, you're going to lose your job. Don't miss it. Don't skip it.
Nice.
Do it.
Nice.
Pick 3 of them.
Yeah.
And start getting in the habit of doing things that you enjoy.
Yeah.
And once you start doing that, all of a sudden you have something to look forward to.
Yes.
You're making your life a little bit more wholesome than just this all work or all this or all this. And every time I present that homework to somebody, I see it in their faces. They do this self-reflection going, mm-hmm. Oh my. Yeah. It's like, yeah, why are you not doing these things? Is it money? All right, then you go back to your list and start listing things that you can do that doesn't cost you anything. Right. If you love going for walks in the park, or if during autumn you like walking in the leaves, last time I checked, they don't charge fees to walk. I'm not trying to give any governments any tax ideas, you know. No, you can go do that. If it's drinking coffee, then make your coffee at home and bring it with you.
Yeah.
If it's going to
ways around it.
Yeah. If it's going to the movies, go on cheap movie day, or, you know, join points programs to get discount, whatever it takes. Right. You can experience these things. Why are you robbing yourself of things that you enjoy to do? It doesn't make any sense. So stop doing that.
Yeah. Well, are there any answers like of any kind, like besides martyrdom, or I don't know.
I think that they're so, and again, this goes back to the type A personalities, they're so driven and they want to impress. And it might be another component of, I see a lot of these people, is they're people pleasers, okay? And there's a great book that came out in 2001. It's called Disease to Please. I highly recommend this book.
Because I like that.
It will give you, and there's exercises throughout it, and there's actually a 21-day exercise to go through some things at the end of the book.
Disease to Please, is that what it's called?
Disease to Please, yes.
Yeah, we're going to promote that, because it affects, oh my gosh, if you're not a narcissist, it's almost, you're the opposite. You're the people pleaser that they love to stomp on.
Yeah, or you could be a codependent, and I see that a lot of times where, you know, they're that. So, like, when I encounter executives that are narcissists, they're not burned out. They don't tend to be. I mean, that's a big paintbrush to use, but I find a lot of times it's, you know, codependents or people that want to, you know, impress others, because that's how they were able to do it. And, you know, much like anything, they did this, they received positive affirmation. So they've associated, if I do this, then I get this, which is fine, but you have to take care of yourself first. And that tends to be the, you know, things that get shoved to the side. I see it with parents. Sure. I see it with executives. I see it with caregivers. I see it with middle management. I see it with frontline. I see it, everybody. It's like they say, well, I'll take care of myself later. I'll go do this. It's like trying to drive a car with no gas in it. Now, unless it's a Tesla, you need gas. When we're all electric cars, I'll come up without, you know, charging your batteries. It's the same thing. You have to make sure that your batteries are fully charged.
Yes, you do.
Because when you do that, if you take care of yourself first, and is it selfish? Yes, you need to be. Or it's self-care is more the best way to describe it.
It is.
Because if you're giving of yourself and you're at 100%, then what you're giving and helping out people is so much better than what you were doing before, because you're full of energy. You have clarity. Yes. You feel good. Yes. You're in a place where you can give and still receive. Yes. It makes a huge difference. Yes. And you notice your life, organization you work for, just yes. thrives, because you're at your optimum best. So that's, if anybody takes anything away from our conversation today, focus on yourself, make sure you're the best version of you, and how that looks from a health standpoint, you know, nutrition, mindfulness, exercise, all of these things. Take the best care of yourself that you can, because otherwise you can be the youngest person in a cardiac ward, which did get a lot of attention with the nurses, because they're usually dealing with 70 and 80 year old people.
Oh,
so that,
gosh, that's something to be known for.
No, exactly. No, I was like, you know, the nurses, you know, stopped by to see how I was doing. I'm like, I'm fine at that point. You know, I was like, I'm all hooked up. Everything's good to go. But I could tell they were, it was kind of like a science experiment going, why do we have a kid in here? You know? So yeah. That's basically how it felt.
Yeah. So, sometimes the hand is forced, either way, there's gotta be a change of some sort. How do you define bold as in a particular way? I'd like for you to share that right now as we wind this down, cause I want to leave people with this thought, where you said that, being bold.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember what my quote is.
It's okay if we don't have it exactly. I know you had it. I apologize for starting it out that way. I had it on this morning, and I was like, God, that's so smart. And here I've forgotten it.
Living life with boldness is crucial. You are the captain of your own life, okay? A lot of people, for some reason, give control of their lives to someone else, whether it's a spouse, partner, parent, boss, things like that. And it's not their lives, it's yours.
That's it.
And live your life
yes.
the best way you can. Yes, there's circumstances, and I understand finances, jobs. I know all of that stuff. I lived all that stuff. I've got the t-shirt and the stents to prove it. But at the end of the day, it is your life. You have the power to choose differently. And does that mean your choices are going to be easy to roll out? Maybe, maybe not. But you know, own them. You know, own it. It's like, okay, if you're tired of doing something, you're tired of the way your life is, then take the steps to make it different. You have that power. It's your life. You've got the keys to this car. It's your car. So drive it the way you want to drive it.
I love that. I love that. Thank you, Michael. Where can they get in touch with you as a coach, a speaker, and you're an author, two-time author?
Yep. The best way to find me is breakfastleadership.com. And then also, if they want to go to breakfastleadership.com/bucket list, that list that I talked about of, the left side of all the stuff, I've got a free template on there that they can grab. So it says, you know, list your items last time you did it. So that's at breakfastleadership.com/bucket list. And, you know, it's a great resource. I do it. I'm going to do it again now that I try to do it quarterly. Some now that we're into the second quarter of a very fast moving year, I'm going to, you know, list those things out again, because in time things change. Things that you used to enjoy, maybe not so much now. And then there's things that I never thought I'd ever consider doing, actually enjoy doing now. So it's, it's just, you know, we evolve and change over time, and our interests and desires change, but it's good to make sure that you're doing things that bring you joy and happiness in your life, because that's the whole point, is to, you know, live life with joy and happiness. Because when you do that, you know, all those big hurdles and challenges that we face aren't so big when you're operating from a different space.
It is so true. And it's what one of the bottom line is we get the quality of our life often depends on the questions that we ask, or the mm-hmm. people in it. Yes. But so I love this question. And that is, how can I have more fun today than I ever thought possible? And you don't even have to work on it. Your brain will. And at the end of the day, we'll actually have answered that question. And if we could all just add that one little element, that one thing, Imagine what a company would be like if every employee started their day before they left or when they got there, and they just all asked that question and just went about their day, because it will start to show up. It will change things. How can I have more fun today than I ever thought possible? You don't have to share it with anybody. It's not an embarrassing thing. Just ask the freaking question and be amazed at what can happen, because you're looking for it without even trying, and it works. Absolutely. It makes a difference. Yeah,
absolutely.
Thank you for being on Bold Movers and Shakers.
Thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's absolutely my pleasure. Guys, I hope that you'll look up breakfastleadership.com. Michael's podcast is a notable, award-winning. His books are out there. They're best-selling. I'm honored. And I hope that you will take advantage of Michael's breakfastleadership.com/bucket list and start getting on top of your life in the best ways possible. We wish you a great day. Make it a great day. Until we speak again, this is Alexis Ray and Michael Levitt saying goodbye. Bye for now.
Take care, everybody.